Hello and welcome to Bite Back Tracks Books. Today we're turning our eye on the complicated and ever-changing world of the law, specifically the impact that populism is having on the way that we see the judiciary. Are we losing trust in our judges? Here to talk about it is former High Court judge and barrister Inigo Bing, whose upcoming book Populism on Trial tackles just that. Welcome, Inigo.
Inigo Bing, welcome to the Bite Back Virtual Podcast.
Thank you.
Very welcome. And we're here today to talk about your upcoming book, Populism on Trial, which is out this August. And we're all very excited about that. And I have given this a little read and I found it, I mean, complicated, but that's because I haven't studied law, but also very interesting. And I think very pertinent, especially now that, I don't know, there's such tension, I suppose, between the Constitution and Parliament and democracy and all these ideals, which probably isn't being helped by coronavirus. So before we get started, or as you know, our first question, can you talk a little bit about your background, how you became a lawyer, and then your inspiration behind writing Populism on Trial?
Okay, well, I always wanted really to be a barrister. And so that's why I read law at university. I probably should have read history, but I did that later on. And I dabbled a bit in politics while I was a barrister. And then my career developed into judicial work. And so I was, for half my time, a barrister and half my time as a judge. So 20 wow. years in each role. So that was it, really. And then I went to Birkbeck and did what I really wanted to do, which was politics, philosophy and history.
Wow.
Yeah. And then did a new degree and did postgraduate study in history. So that's really the background that got me on to this subject.
And have you always had an interest in politics then?
Yes.
Okay. Kind of getting on to the idea of populism in that case. Can you give a brief description of what the book is about and the dangers, like what populism means for modern Britain? Because your book does focus on the dangers of populism and what that means for the UK.
Yes. Okay. Well, populism is really a completely different sort of politics. I mean, traditionally we've thought, haven't we, that the Labour Party represents organised labour, and I suppose if you might say the working class, and the Conservatives have represented middle class and employers' interests. Populism sees things in a different way. For the populist, you've got kind of two sides. One is the virtuous people who aren't responsible for any of the ills that have come about. On the other side, there are these large institutions and their banks and their European Union, and there's a parliament that doesn't listen to people. And that's a cause, they say, of the problems of the world. And they've been able to say that because of the economic failures of globalization. Now, globalization was really a liberal project. It left people behind. So many industries had to close, many people lost jobs, and there was a fear of overseas labour, and there was a fear of people from overseas coming to Britain to work. And so that stoked up really the situations in which populism can thrive. And populism is able to rely on things being very simple and not complex, because you can blame other people, elites, as they like to call them, or institutions. And as the book talks about, judges, they come into it as well. And in doing so, they do undermine what we take for granted. Mm. And we take for granted that we have an independent judiciary, for example. We take for granted that we have an impartial civil service. We take for granted we have a free press. And we take for granted that we have an elected legislature composed of representatives. And that's, I think, important because our parliamentary democracy depends on people we vote into parliament being our representatives, who are not our masters or our servants. They have to take decisions in between elections. Populists like to say, ah, we're in charge and you must obey us, the people, on everything. And I think that's a bad thing.
Yeah, so fair enough. Did you see evidence of this kind of tension when you were a judge?
What I did notice was that the executive is extremely powerful in holding the purse strings of the administration of justice. So, for example, every court building depends on government funds. Judges are paid by the taxpayer. Barristers doing legal aid work are paid by the taxpayer. And so the executive has quite a strong hand in the administration of justice. And that's what I noticed. Mm. There has traditionally been a very good dialogue. Judges, of course, aren't political. We have our leader, which is the Lord Chief Justice, and he negotiates on behalf of the judiciary about things like court buildings and whether they're properly maintained and are fit for purpose. And of course, the workload, judicial workload and judicial salaries and that sort of thing. But judiciary is vulnerable if there is a very strong populist element to government, because the funds are cut off, then there is a real threat, I think.
What kind of effect would that have on the judiciary? And like, do you see that being a bigger problem in future?
Well, it would have an effect if, and it's already happening, that legal aid is being withdrawn in quite a number of cases where people, particularly in family cases about children, have to represent themselves. Cases take much longer. And that's a strain on the court system. So, you know, it does depend on there being a responsible dialogue between those in government and those who are dealing with justice.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting because I guess populism runs on the idea that what the people want, but then again, it's the people that suffer most when populists are in power, which is very strange.
Yes.
So segueing on from that then, what threat does populism pose to the way in which the UK is run? I think we've already partially covered this, but...
Well, it poses a threat, I think, in three ways. The first is that populism changes the tone of political language. It's very shrill, it's very uncompromising. Populists denigrate their opponents as being completely illegitimate. In the last parliament, anybody that did not want a completely hard Brexit was called a Remona, a rather insulting term. And Jeremy Corbyn was regarded as being completely illegitimate as a politician. And the second threat is that populism thrives because they like to have a strong, charismatic leader who does not like dissent or opposition. We see this happen now under the Johnson government. 21 Conservative MPs had the whip withdrawn from them before the last election. They couldn't stand as Conservative candidates. Many of them just faded away. They're no longer in public life. A great loss to Parliament. Boris Johnson has dismissed his cabinet secretary. He's challenging the ethos of the independent civil service. And I noticed, and it's too late to go in the book, but the day before yesterday, there was a story about government communications being confined now to people working within Number 10 Downing Street, rather than being within the individual ministries. So all these trends show a concentration of power. That's a threat. And I think the third threat is how Parliament is denigrated. Now, Parliament was deadlocked before the last election. There's no disputing that. But after all, it was the Parliament that voters had voted for. Mrs. May did not get the majority that she wanted, and so we had a hung Parliament. Some of Boris Johnson's supporters, particularly, as I single out in the book, Geoffrey Cox, who was Attorney General under Theresa May, just said that this Parliament is not fit to sit. Mm. Well, that's pretty strong language from a legislature that we value for protecting our liberties, I think. But there we are.
Yeah, this is worrying, I would say.
Yeah.
So going back to Boris Johnson in that case, he infamously prorogued Parliament. Was it last year? I think it was.
Yes.
So can you talk a bit about that in that case? Because that seems to sum up quite a lot of the problems and tensions between the UK constitution and Parliament.
Absolutely. And you really hit the nail on the head, because our constitution is entirely unwritten. There are only two documents that have been written down about how we govern ourselves. One of them is Magna Carta, written in 1215, and the other was the Bill of Rights, written in 1689. Wow. And we depend on conventions in our unwritten constitution. And in that sense, Britain as a constitutional monarchy is different from almost all other constitutions in the world, different certainly from the European constitutions, America certainly very different, and the Commonwealth countries. And so that does leave quite a scope for anybody that does not want to play by the rules, really. And there was a convention that you didn't just shut Parliament down to stifle discussion or debate. But on the other hand, what law was there against it? Because there was nothing written down. It was just expected that people would behave in a certain way. Johnson shut it down, and that led to the Supreme Court case. Now, you may say, well, that's all right, because we'll let the Supreme Court make these decisions. But in fact, somebody has got to take the case to the Supreme Court. And the person that took the case was Gina Miller. Yes. It was the same person that had taken the government to court over the notorious enemies of the people. And she had threats to her life. Her way of life was made very uncomfortable for her. So we're in a situation where some individual has to be very brave to take the government to court. And the important decision of the Supreme Court was that proroguing Parliament is a constitutional issue and not just a party political issue. And as soon as it becomes a constitutional issue, it becomes a question of law, which the Supreme Court is able to make a ruling on. Johnson didn't like the result, but that's really, I think, the basic points about the prorogation decision.
I didn't realise that we didn't have a written constitution. That makes it slightly terrifying to think that we've got such a fragile balance between Parliament, law and the judiciary and all that. So.
Yeah.
Bit worrying.
Yes. Yes.
Expanding on that a little bit then, this relationship between Parliament and the executive and the judiciary, like how has it developed over the years? You're saying that you discussed the history between it in your book, and I know there's three distinct phases that you cover. So can you talk a little bit about those?
About the phases?
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose that the backdrop is that there are traditionally really separate functions. Parliament is supreme and makes law. The executive carry out the laws made by Parliament on Parliament's behalf, and the judges sit on disputes about those laws. That's essentially the three roles. Now, in my book, I've talked about a phased way in which these relationships have changed. I deal with both criminal and civil law in the book. In the criminal phase, it was the phase really of miscarriages of justice. And they occurred because there was a reliance that the police would behave completely above the board and would not induce or obtain false confessions from suspects at police stations. There'd be no independent supervision of what the police did in police stations. And so phase one was fairly grim for people in the criminal sphere. In the civil courts, judges really did not believe it was any part of their role to take a stand against the state or against the government. They had an exclusive role of just adjudicating disputes between individual citizens or a citizen and a company, that sort of thing, but not to challenge the government itself. That was not something that judges thought was their role at all. Phase two, which I thought began in about the mid-1980s and went on to the Brexit referendum, was for the criminal side of things, a great period of reform. And governments acted very well, and police became subject to law. They were under law, and solicitors visit police stations, and solicitors sit with suspects while interviews take place. And so false confessions really have been abolished. They don't exist anymore. And at the same time, in the civil courts, there were areas of dispute which were involving politics. For example, there was a phase when grammar schools were being phased out and comprehensive schools were being phased in. And there was a lot of dispute as to how fast that was happening, and people were taking one side or another, and the judges were drawn into that. Judges were drawn into planning disputes. there was a big dispute, wasn't there, about Heathrow Airport very recently.
Yeah.
But all that sort of thing had started in the 1980s. And it was that the politicians resented. They thought, well, these trends are making judges too powerful. And therefore, we as politicians need to put judges back in their box. Phase three really is the fallout from the referendum. And essentially, this is a big constitutional question of who is in charge. If Parliament is supreme, and really is supreme, then how can logically a referendum vote change that? And yet those who wanted the referendum vote to be implemented said, well, no, the people are supreme. But that involved quite complex questions of how the referendum results should be interpreted, who should interpret it, what role should Parliament. And one of the things I say in my book is politicians lost their heads in a huge constitutional muddle about this, and I talk a bit about that. So that's really phase three.
I don't think they've regained their heads, to be honest. They're still, still flapping around. Yeah. Do you think there's any scope for the UK to get a written constitution in that case? Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, Lord Scarman is a figure that I talk about in this book, and he has always been in favour of a written constitution. And there are a lot of academic lawyers and quite a lot of judges who believe we should have a written constitution. Equally, there are others who say that it might be too inflexible, but that is an ongoing debate. I don't actually deal with it very much in the book, but it's a current issue of debate. Mm. And populism may actually prompt those that oppose populism to say, well, populism could be restrained if we did have a written constitution.
Bit of a thorny issue in that case.
It is a thorny issue. It's not an easy one. I don't think anyone says, oh, that's, we can cure populism by having a written constitution. It's not as simple as that.
No, absolutely. Talking then about kind of this power struggle then between the executive, parliament, the judiciary, do you think it's possible to safely give power to the executives, and how, if so?
Well, the executive must have power, because otherwise government would grind to a halt. I mean, if you take coronavirus, there's a big argument about whether the lockdown happened too late, whether it should have happened more quickly. But it's beyond dispute that the executive had to act with some authority, and the authority was given by Parliament very quickly. There was hardly any opposition, if any opposition, to it. So that did give the executive power. And even in normal times, government really can't function without the executive having power. But power must be lawfully exercised. And that really is the point of this. And I deal with two separate sorts of cases. I deal quite a bit with terrorism. Terrorism has, you know, is a dreadful scourge, and people are in fear of bombs going off and being blown up by terrorists and things. But you can't just say, well, let's suspend our laws because we've got a terrorist problem. You have to deal with the terrorist problem within the law that judges lay down. Mm. And it was very unpopular what the judges did. They were attacked for it. But I'm, in my book, argue that they were entirely right to put some restraint on overweening executive power. For example, unlimited detention without trial for foreign nationals is something that the government were contemplating. Exactly. So it's difficult. And then I deal also, as, by way of examples, with what the government wanted to do about asylum seekers and restricting the state benefits that they were entitled to claim. Well, the judges said, well, that's all very well, this is what Parliament wants to do, but did Parliament really intend that an asylum seeker and their family should be completely and utterly destitute without any means of support at all? So these are the sort of problems that arise when you give the executive power. The rules that they have to work under, they're called codes and rules of procedure, the judges interpret those. And that's their role and function. And politicians often say, well, they're getting in the way. I argue that they're not. They're upholding certain basic libertarian principles.
Yeah, absolutely. With all of this tension going on and this power struggles, I think it's not really a surprise that you say in the book that the public's trust in law is eroding.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that and about how we can, or if we can, improve the public's trust in law again?
Yes. I mean, the low point was the Daily Mail headline, Enemies of the People, when all the judges did was say that the Prime Minister of the time, Theresa May, had to obtain the consent of Parliament to invoke Article 50. It wasn't incredibly controversial. And yet to style judges as revolutionaries in the Reign of Terror in France in 1794, or not zealous enough communists under Stalin in Russia in the 1930s, was appalling, and it deliberately undermined trust. And so I think the first thing is that politicians and the press must recognise what role the judiciary does actually perform and report it accurately. I give dozens of examples in my chapter on human rights about the misreporting of decisions, where the press want to characterize the exercise of rights as just a charter for murderers and rapists and that sort of thing. Well, that doesn't help people trust judges to impartially hand out the rule of law. So I think that those are two things that might be done.
That sounds common sense, and I don't know why the press is a bit of a scourge, I think, sometimes. So pivoting from populism now to a liberal democracy, which is arguably the complete opposite of populism, can you talk a little bit about the hallmarks of liberal democracy and as we've transitioned from period, I suppose, of liberal democracy to one of populism? Can you talk a bit about how liberal democracy's weaknesses kind of paved the way for populism, or what populism offers that this other system does not?
Yes, it's a very good question.
Very big question, I'm afraid.
Good one, yes. Okay, so the hallmarks. Well, I think there are really four key hallmarks. First is that under a liberal democracy, you have free and fair elections at periodic intervals. And the obvious point about free elections is that you have elections not with outside influence, whether it's from Russia or other foreign powers, elections that are not overtly influenced by fake news, elections that are not overtly influenced by the power of money. So we need to not just assume that we have fair elections, they've got to be free and fair. And the second hallmark of liberal democracy is that liberal democracies don't believe that pure majoritarianism is enough, because if it's just the rule of the majority, then the rights of unpopular minorities, and you can think of all sorts of unpopular minorities, their status and rights within society are not protected. The third hallmark is an independent judiciary who should be able to exist and apply the judicial oath, which is to give judgment according to law without favour, affection or ill will to whoever it is that appears before the judge. And last but not least, of course, a free press. And that really means that each side must have an equal chance to argue their case, and that press is not dominated by particular conglomerates that may influence opinion. So I think those are the key hallmarks. And then I think you wanted me to go on about, well, why is that weak?
I guess how it created weaknesses that populists have exploited.
Yes. I think myself that the real weakness is the economic weakness. Liberals are very good at thinking about how power should be shared and how rights should be upheld. Liberals are less good at economic models. Now, we had the economic model of Mrs. Thatcher. Now, that was pure free market capitalism. Now, that's really dying away now and a bit out of fashion. Liberals haven't come up with an alternative, and therefore has been a distrust of international institutions, a cynicism about globalization. And it's a cynicism that's rightly held. I mean, if you are a steel worker in Sheffield, then how do you feel if all the steel that is bought comes from China or Poland, or the coal that we burn comes from Poland rather than the pits in Yorkshire? So populism is able to exploit that economic weakness. And I think the second thing is that liberal globalization has involved a decline of nationalism and patriotism to an extent. And populists are very fond of saying, oh, you're not patriotic. They hark back to a better yesterday, always, about their patriotism, but they have hit on a chink in the liberal armour about that, I think. So that's a weakness. How populists attack liberal democracy? Well, they make a main plank of their attack the fact that liberal democracy is associated with rights. Now, populists like to think that rights are for other people. They're only for murderers and rapists and undesirables, gypsies and people like that, who look to the Human Rights Act to protect their way of life and their way they choose to behave. In fact, of course, it's not nearly as simple as that. I mean, if you think of the things that we almost take for granted, we take for granted that we have personal autonomy, we take for granted that we have gender equality, we take for granted we have free speech, we take for granted that we have certain things that are private and that no one else has any business discussing or looking into. That's our privacy. And yet, these are things that are given to us by rights. And so rights do affect everybody, actually. Mm. And once you start chipping away at them, then, you know, you are on a slippery slope, I think, to authoritarianism and tyranny. And so I think we need to keep our eye on that ball.
So what kind of future do you see for the UK in that case? Do you see us becoming more populist, or do you think that there'll be a backlash to that?
Well, obviously, I hope there will be a backlash, which is why I hope lots of people buy my book and read it.
But being a
realist about it, I mean, Johnson has an 80-seat majority. Now, he made all the Conservative candidates at the last general election sign a pledge of loyalty to him. And he is going about being Prime Minister in, I think, quite an authoritarian populist way. And we'll have to wait and see what happens with the opposition. I mean, people are saying Sir Keir Starmer is quite different from Jeremy Corbyn, and he may well be. And the Labour Party may well take a principled stand against some of the things that populists are undermining. I hope they do, but I think that that's not for judges to say.
Moving on to a more impartial way of phrasing it, are there any ways in which you think we could improve the system?
Well, I think that it is important that populist jargon and populist arguments are rebutted. Bill Clinton, when he was standing for President of the United States, had a whole unit he called the rebuttal unit. And Tony Blair had the same tactic, that when you're attacked, then you rebut the attack. You don't just lie down and let the attack crawl over you. One of the reasons for the book is, of course, judges by their office and their neutrality can't enter into this sort of controversy themselves. Now, I'm retired, I'm free to speak what I think, say what I think, and to stand up for some of the things that the judge has been doing. So that's, I think, the first thing. I mean, the second thing is that I think we need some accuracy in reporting, and we need to keep a close eye on what goes on in newspapers that don't report truthfully. I mean, the Leveson inquiry did quite a lot towards that, helpfully. But yes, eternal vigilance, I think.
Excellent. Well, rounding up the interview in that case, what's one thing you hope people take away from reading Populism on Trial?
I suppose the main thing is populism isn't funny. You may say, well, what a funny thing to say. But I was at a small conference when somebody from the BBC was speaking, and somebody asked a question, well, why is Nigel Farage so often on television? His party had no MPs. And the person from the BBC said, well, Farage makes very good telly. And of course he does, because he has that sort of personality and people think that he's a jolly, funny sort of fellow. And Boris Johnson has many of the same qualities, that he's good at jokes and he makes people think that he's funny. But actually, populism isn't funny, populism is dangerous. So that's what I hope they'll take away. And I hope also that they'll take away the fact that we must learn from history. There's no better yesterday, there's only better tomorrow.
That's a good point and very interesting note to end on. So thank you so much for appearing on the podcast.
Not at all.
Thanks for listening to another Bite Back podcast. If listening to Inigo has made you want to find out more about the complicated relationship we have with the law, then his book, Populism on Trial, is out on the Bite Back website and Amazon on the 20th of August. And don't forget to like and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time!